And you've been listening to a debate between Deepak Chopra and Leonard Mlodinow as we talk about War of the World Views. I've got one more question for them, and then we'll take your questions on Coast to Coast AM. Leonard, one more question for you and Deepak, then we'll go to the phone calls. Do you believe in life after death? Do you believe that there's a soul and that it carries on?
Well, George, I would love to believe that, but I don't believe that. The idea of a soul, is something outside of the physical universe that would affect the physical person is something that doesn't really fit in with the scientific picture. It's something that I believe if there was a soul that in some way controlled or affected the human being, that we would notice that, when we make our measurements on the human being, that the laws that we know apply. See, from what we can tell, all the laws that apply to the physical world of inanimate objects are the same laws that apply to describing humans, and so these don't include a soul. So, I think it's unfortunate. And I'd love to believe it, but I feel that I have to have the courage to accept that this is all that there is, and on the other hand, use that as a motivation to make the most of it and to live for the present and live for live this life and not not for any looking forward to another life. And when my loved ones go, unfortunately, then they're gone, and all there are memories.
Deepak, how about you? Life after death?
Yes, but I have to explain that a little bit. So
okay.
I do not see life as the opposite of death. I see birth as the opposite of death, and I see life as the continuum of birth and death, because anything that's born has to die, and it's vice versa as well, because that's the process of transformation. A child dies to become a teenager. A teenager dies to become an adult. So you have to go a little deeper and to say, what is death? And death is actually, in my view, a creative process. Our cells in the body have to die. In fact, we have a term for it in biology. It's called programmed cellular death, or apoptosis is the word. And when cells forget to die, that's a cancer cell. A cancer cell has lost the memory of death because it doesn't think literally from, a consciousness perspective that it's part of the whole body. It's on an independent journey, independent of the wholeness, which is part of its body. So I see death as a continuum of transformation and evolution. And you have to then say, what dies? And what dies is an individual identity that is misperceived as permanent, because you're not the same person you were 10 years ago, hopefully. You have a different body, you have a more mature mind, and at some level a different personality. So, you are constantly and ever in a phase of transformation. A caterpillar dies to become a butterfly. And so I see that if you can shift your identity to a deeper level, and I'll have to use a poetic metaphor here, like Rumi, the great Sufi poet, he says, you're not just a drop in the ocean, you're the mighty ocean in the drop. So if you can shift your perspective to your larger cosmic identity, then there's no death.
Very good. Let's go to the phones. Our first-time caller is Sasan in Laguna Niguel in California. Go ahead, Sasan.
Hi, thank you for taking me. Just want to say beforehand, I have a great respect, especially for Leonard, and appreciate both of your works. And I just wanted to make two quick points and questions, actually, and I'll get off the line and listen for both your answers. First of all, both of you, Leonard and Dr. Chopra, mentioned in regards to religion and morality. My question was, hasn't religion... I think as Steven Weinberg said, with or without religion, you would have good people doing good things and evil people doing evil things. Religion allows good people to do evil things. So hasn't that actually been a detriment to human society? And also in regard to Deepak, I wanted to ask you, with science and you know, with the stuff that you say, aren't you kind of trying to have your cake and eat it at the same time? Because all these fancy words and scientific terms, isn't that just a kind of a way to try to make what you say sound scientific when in reality it's not? Thank you for your time.
Okay. So the first question about religion, yes. Self-imposed morality or self-righteous morality, as H.G. Wells said, is just jealousy with a halo. So there's been a lot of bad things that have occurred through religious dogma and ideology. In fact, we're still doing that. As far as vocabulary is concerned, you know, biologists have their own vocabulary, and so do scientists have their own vocabulary, and so do medical doctors have their own vocabulary. Every discipline has its own vocabulary. I attend many, many conferences on consciousness with many peers, and the vocabulary that I use is not invented. It's part of the perennial traditions of philosophy, the perennial traditions that study consciousness, the vocabulary that has been used by Emerson and Thoreau, and these days by friends who work in consciousness, like Sir Roger Penrose. It has been used by even other great scientists like John Wheeler, like Freeman Dyson. So I haven't invented the vocabulary. In fact, I'm borrowing it.
Okay.
This is one of the themes in the book that I talk about, and we bat back and forth a little bit, is the use of scientific terminology and how we make our definitions and the differences between how you define terms in science and outside of science, where they're less precisely defined, and what the consequences are of that.
Next up, we go to Steve in Grants, New Mexico, west of the Rockies. Go ahead, Steve.
Hi, guys. Thanks for staying up to talk with us tonight.
Super.
I have a question probably for both of you. It seems like the time between when we have a concept or an idea and when it materializes is getting shorter and shorter. I'm wondering if that's really happening, and if so, we might reach a point where that time period is so short that it kind of collapses, where it's more of instantaneous or kind of like a sonic boom of sorts. And if so, maybe this is already happening, and the creation before us is maybe the result of thoughts that we just haven't had yet.
Who wants that? That's pretty heavy and deep. Deepra, do you want that, Deepak?
Well, I'm not sure I can answer his question fully because I don't totally understand it. But, you know, there is such a thing as collective intelligence and collective creativity. I use it myself as a physician, where I can get a lot of people, even on the internet. I've done that through Yahoo Answers to solve a problem, and you find that, you know, when everybody kind of puts their intent together on solving a problem, the solution happens much faster than when an individual does it. But I think he means something else, and I'm not really qualified to answer that.
All right. And Leonard, let me ask you something about time. Why does it seem, the older we get, that it seems to be going faster and faster and faster?
Well, that's a good question. And I forgot who it was, but somebody came up with the theory that, you know, any interval in time, in the psychological feeling of that time, interval in time, it should be judged not according to the absolute value of that, you know, how many seconds or minutes or days that was, but the fraction of your life that you've lived so far that takes up. So when you're 1 day old, you live another day, that's half your life. That seems like a very long time. I remember when I was in school, when I was 10 years old, a year was 10% of my life. It seemed very long, and now I'm in my 50s, so it's a couple percent of my life, and it seems very, you know, five times shorter. And I, to me, that's I don't know what the deeper, perhaps, scientific explanation is, but that's the way it seems to work to me, that
you know, the older you get, the more you've lived, then the less significant a certain period of time becomes in comparison.
Okay. Let's go to George, Austin, Texas. Go ahead, George. You're up.
I have a question for Deepak. Do you see a time when integrative medicine, or let's say alternative medicine in the United States and hopefully around the globe, reaches an equal level to that of pharmaceuticals, and at the same time, when maybe pharmaceuticals don't cost near what they cost this time across the board? And pardon me, really enjoyed the debate. It seemed as though several times Deepak's words were spoken over, but I guess that's the nature of a debate sometimes. I'll listen off air for the answers. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, so, you know, when I started my career, when I shifted from endocrinology and internal medicine to integrative medicine, it was really a minority of people who were seeking it and a minority of people who were practicing it. In 30 years, we've come a long way. We have medical students rotating through the Chopra Center. We have a continuing medical education course going on for physicians twice a year. The American Medical Association asked me to do an op-ed recently. So, you know, I think there's a much greater acceptance. As far as comparing it to pharmaceutical intervention and surgery and other things that we see in modern medicine, like scientific medicine, like diagnostics, the most promising area is diagnostics. You know, we have now amazing technology that can detect illness in the very early stages. You can look inside cells with functional MRIs. You can track a thought in the brain, even though the thought, in my view, doesn't originate in the brain, but has its signature in neural networks. So diagnostics is going to get even better. Pharmaceuticals, 80% of the pharmaceuticals we use are of optional and marginal benefit, which means if you didn't use them, it wouldn't make a bit of a difference to the natural history of that disease. But 20% are life-saving. Similarly, there's a lot of surgery that's done that is not indicated, but the medical profession is realizing that and actually slowly moving in that direction. Do I see a time when pharmaceuticals will not be that expensive? Yes. You know, right now in China and India, you can get pharmaceuticals for 1/10, sometimes 1/50th, sometimes 1/100th of the price that you get them in the United States. Now, of course, you know, the United States pharmaceutical companies claim that those pharmaceuticals made in China are not reliable, they don't have the same quality control, et cetera, which in some cases is true, in some cases is not true. But as these technologies and methods become refined, and the pharmaceuticals will be much more inexpensive, but we'll have to change some of our laws in order to make use of those inexpensive pharmaceuticals.
Okay, let's go to Bill in West Hartford, Connecticut. Hi, Bill. Go ahead.
Yes, hi, Leonard and Deepak. Hi, yes, hi. I'm a scientific-minded atheist, and I have a quick point that you didn't mention, and then just one question that both of you may not have thought of that relates to string theory to the human brain's composition, meaning string theory to consciousness. And my point simply is, first, there is a book by Dr. Victor J. Stenger, astrophysicist, I'm sure you heard of him, Leonard, called God, the Failed Hypothesis, How Science Shows That God does not exist. And my question to you specifically is, breaking down ultimately all the atoms of the brain down to its strings of vibrating energy, could the sum total of all the brain's strings of energy be an energy field, which is the mind or the consciousness and not the soul, and could the energy that's really not the spirit or in a religious sense or a spiritual sense be, after one dies, possibly exist in an energy dimension or an energy universe, which religious people wrongly and misguidedly call heaven or hell?
Either one of you. You want to take that first, Leonard?
Well, the strings and string theory are
if string theory is correct, which we haven't we haven't proven yet, they exist at such a fundamental level that they really would not be able to affect the way that you think or consciousness. It's something that is at such a deep or low level physically, so much removed from the nuclei, the atoms, the molecules of your brain they really wouldn't have a particular relevance for consciousness. That, okay. Anyway, that's my guess, because we don't really even know what consciousness is, nor do we know whether string theory is correct.
Well, I suspect Deepak knows what consciousness is, don't you?
It's the one that we're using to communicate with each other right now. Consciousness is everything that we call experience, cognition, moods and emotions, thoughts, perception, biological responses. Without consciousness, there's no life. So I would say life and consciousness to a great extent are synonymous. But to answer that gentleman's question, I didn't understand the question.
By the way, I might add that I don't agree that science has proved that there is no God. If that's what this fellow said, I think he's a
atheist, yes.
A particle physicist. Yeah.
Let's go to Tony in St. Louis. Go ahead, Tony. You're up with us.
Good morning, gentlemen. Let me start off by saying, as an avid listener, this has all the makings of a classic Coast to Coast episode.
Super.
I have a two-part question for you two gentlemen. I believe it's the third law of thermodynamics states that matter has to go from simple to complex. If you heat up a pot of coffee and then you take away the energy source, then it goes to cold. Now, in terms of life, it seems that life has already became the complex. There really was no simple version of humans or anything that breathes and reproduces, for that matter. And to touch on that, as I understand it, life was created from amino acids binding with the energy from the volcanic ocean vent, if you will, and that's what created life. Wouldn't it be possible, in the almost infinite number of planets with our relation to their sun, that would cause perfect, the perfect balance for life? Wouldn't it be possible that we would be everywhere? And I thank you for your time.
Okay, we would be everywhere. We're coming up to the break, but Leonard, let me ask you this first. Do you believe in intelligent life out there in space, or do you think we're it?
This is a very good question, George. I believe that science really does not know. We don't know at all whether there is. I can tell you more details later. But I find that when I examine my own feelings, I personally have faith. I have a feeling, a gut feeling, that there is intelligent life elsewhere. Yes.
We'll come back to both of your remarks on that one when we come back. Well, on our next Coast to Coast program, The Witch's Book of the Dead with Christian Day, followed by those Friday night and the Saturday morning open lines. And in just a moment, we'll come back with Deepak Chopra and Leonard Mlodinow, War of the World Views, and final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, Deepak. I'll let you comment, too, on the last caller's thoughts about life in the universe. Is it teeming, do you think, or are we it?
You know, I'd like to quote Carl Sagan when he was asked that question. He said, if there is life in the universe, that's amazing. And if there's none and we are all by ourselves, that's amazing. Either way.
Either way, indeed. Let's go back to the calls. Farmington, Missouri. It's Jason's turn on Coast to Coast. Go ahead, Jason.
Hey, George. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you.
George, when do you ever sleep? I see you all over the place. I seen you on Alex Jones the other day.
Very rare. Very rare.
Okay, my question is to Leonard, and I have one for Deepak, too. I'll make it real fast. Leonard, the human soul, do you believe that humans have a soul?
No, I don't.
You don't? Okay, so you believe this is just what we are, our body is just, that's it, really. That's all we are.
Yeah, I believe that our body is, you know, made of physical, chemical elements, atoms and molecules, and, you know, that's all we are. But, I mean, I don't mean that to say that people are soulless right. in the sense that, you know, there's no human spirit, but that just that arises from the atoms and molecules in our body, and there's nothing, no other force or material that would survive if our body is destroyed.
Right,
and,
right.
Yeah, I mean, so in the book we talk about this issue at length, and the question of whether there is there can be or a separate existence outside of the physical body.
Mm-hmm. My question to Dr. Chopra is: do you think that mainstream science is how can I put this?
Go ahead.
That they're flawed, that intellectually dishonest.
Intellectually?
No, I don't think so. Mainstream science is not intellectually dishonest, but in mainstream science is built on a mechanistic interpretation of reality. So I go back to your question, do you think there's a soul? And if by soul you mean consciousness, I think that's all there is, that, you know, we don't experience chemicals, we experience colors and sounds and tastes and smells and touch. We experience a noisy, colorful, smelly world, not atoms and molecules. So our bodies are experienced in our consciousness, the world is experienced in our consciousness, and our mental thoughts are also experienced in our consciousness. All we experience is sensations, images, feelings, and thoughts. Everything that you can call an experience falls in those categories. So in contrast to Leonard, I think all you have is a soul.
Leonard, earlier I was talking with Deepak. We wanted to talk about free will. Do you think we have free will as human beings?
Well, so this is, again, exactly the same question. And to me, the question is, do we believe that the laws of nature govern, human beings as well as rocks and stars and planets? And I do believe that they do. And so if the laws of nature govern a human being, that means that the laws of nature govern, you know, the human being's behavior, thoughts, feelings. And so in a sense, there's no free will because it all arises from those laws of nature. There's no soul, if there's no soul hovering in some other realm that's you know, making the decisions for you, that's exercising the free will. You know, in order to have free will, who's exercising the free will? Is that whatever it is exercising the free will, a physical being that's subject to the laws of nature, or is it something outside the laws of nature? And since I believe that everything is subject to the laws of nature, then, you know, in some sense there is no free will. However, that doesn't mean that from a practical point of view, of course, there's free will. I decide to have, crab instead of an omelet. Then that's a decision that I make. I feel like I'm making the decision. I'm thinking about the decision. So just because the laws of nature are governing that, and perhaps my eventual decision to have one item to eat over another was determined, you know, by the laws of nature, And if you had the right equations and the right knowledge, you could have predicted what I would have said. That's really a moot point because we don't know that. And for me, I certainly felt free in making my decision. But, you know, my decision could have been determined by who I am, by my past experiences, by my tastes, all of which are physical aspects of me. And yet at the moment of the decision, I feel like I'm choosing. So I'm not going to say walk in front of a truck because it doesn't really matter. There's no free will. I'm going to choose not to and to preserve myself. And, you know, whether or not that is determined by the, you know, even if that's determined by the laws of physics, doesn't mean that it's not feel like I'm making a choice.
And did he answer that the way you wanted him to, Deepak?
No, he didn't. I mean, there are other scientists like Dyson Freeman, Henry Stapp,
Freeman Dyson.
I could name a slew of them, who say that actually choice is inherent in every aspect of nature, that when we do expensive experiments we do are based on the questions that we ask. So, and again, you know, I do this at the risk of annoying Leonard, there is such a thing that people like Henry Stapp and Tyson Freeman and many others invoke called quantum uncertainty, which allows for free will at every level.
Let's go to Barbara now in Portland, Oregon.
Let's do that.
Sure.
Quantum uncertainty is a purely random process, has nothing to do with choice or free will. If you take a quantum coin and you flip it, it tells you that sometimes it'll come up heads and sometimes it'll come up tails, but there's no choice involved. It all comes with a certain statistical precision, and so that's just a red herring.
Consciousness is the field of uncertainty, which is also the field of creativity. Without uncertainty, there's no creativity. Do we have creativity in a mechanistic universe, Leonard?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure what that means, but I mean, creativity. Just in terms of, I can speak to
physics.
You have
this very wonderful thing when you, I'm not sure what you mean by consciousness, I'm not sure what you mean by creativity. I mean, we did the book together, that was a creative process.
Right, but what I do know is what the laws of quantum physics mean, and there is no will being exercised through the laws of quantum physics.
Well, I just showed
pure,
you,
it's pure, excuse me, Deepak,
I showed you
it's pure randomness.
Dyson Freeman, agree, has made major contributions to physics.
Well, but many people make major contributions to physics and then say things that other physicists don't believe in, and this is a case of that where almost no one believes what he has to say in that regard. So, I mean, physics is not a field. See, as opposed to spirituality, as opposed to spirituality, which is always quoting. wisdom of people from a long time ago.
In
physics, we keep moving forward, and when someone is an authority and someone has made a great contribution in science,
absolutely,
we don't
not.
Necessarily I... take every Deepak. Can I finish? We don't necessarily take everything that person says to be the truth. In physics, we check it, and everyone in physics has equal footing to an equal claim to the truth. And the way we judge the truth is by the quality of the ideas and whether they check out. So when Freeman Dyson says things like that, other people just don't believe him. They don't say, because Freeman Dyson in 1948
like
made a great contribution, when he says in 1984, we're going to take it as gospel. We go, well, how does it really work? And in this case, when he says that, he's not right.
Yeah, but okay. You say that of a lot of people. You say that of John.
I don't
Wheeler.
Say that of a lot.
You say that of... Heisenberg, you say that of so many other people that, it sounds to me like you should have made those same contributions as they did.
Well, I say that, first of all, I'm not talking about my judgment of these people that you're talking about. I'm talking about the mainstream physics community's judgment. So,
and also, by the
make
way,
it personal.
Wait,
Deepak, let me,
things on authority.
Deepak, let me finish.
About observing your own self.
Deepak, can I finish my statement? So don't make it personal and say whether or not I'm judging them. I'm talking about the physics community. And I'm not saying that of a large number of people. I'm saying that of a handful of people that you've hand-selected who say things that you feel support your point of view. But 999 out of every 1,000 physicists disagree with those people.
Well, we went to a conference in Sweden where there were 500 people talking about consciousness.
Oh, you can find thousands of people talking about consciousness. I'm just
they
saying
were,
that very few physicists hold this point of view.
You came to the same conference.
Yeah, I came to the conference to express my point of view.
Yeah, but you realize that there were many other points of view there.
There are many points of view. That doesn't make them all right. But, there were very
but
few physicists there,
right,
I have
right?
to say. The physicists generally disdain, and neuroscientists disdain those conferences.
Let's take a few more calls, you two. Let's go to Barbara in Portland, Oregon. Go ahead, Barbara.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Wonderful debate going on. I was just wondering, gentlemen, if you could let me know your opinion on, is man or humanity the same or greater than the other animals on this planet?
Aha. Interesting question. Barbara?
Yes. I'm sorry. Wait.
In what respect?
Oh, in what respect? I suppose in all respects. Well, probably mentally the most. Physically, of course not.
Okay, what do you think? Is man high up on the totem pole or what with the animal world? Leonard?
Well, you know, I think that the differences between people and animals, you know, people, one of the main differences is that people are very social, more social than other animals. If you look, you know, there are other social animals such as bees, which have highly cooperative societies, but
and ants too. Really,
and ants, exactly, but they don't have the same complexity in their relationship. So ants don't look at other ants and go, "I know what you're thinking," or "I know what you're thinking of me," or "I know what you think I'm thinking of you." And humans, we can go very deep in this kind of a discussion because we all have our own assessments of each other, and we have our own interactions, which, you know, allow us to form great communities, and you know, and we feel love and to feel different social emotions and to draw together to build great societies and great buildings, and so I think that one of the things that makes people, the human being, different from other animals is this great capacity for complex social interaction.
All right, Deepak, do you want to react to that too?
I would defer because I believe in free will, and I think human beings have free will and choice. So that makes them paradoxical. You know, on the one hand, we ask ourselves questions like, do we have a soul or not? We do science. We invent art, poetry, civilization. And on the other hand, we kill our own species in the name of God. So, you know, the free will is both a gift and a curse.
Let's go to Thomas in Jacksonville, Florida. First-time caller. Hi, Thomas. Go ahead.
Hi. I have an easier question for Mr. Chopra to answer, I think.
All right. We'll try.
A few years back, you were involved in producing a comic graphic novel called Ramion, and it was awesome. Excellent story, gorgeous artwork. Had two volumes that ended with a giant cliffhanger, and then it just went away. I was wondering if that was ever going to be
picked back up. That was a partnership with Sir Richard Branson, and it was then called Virgin Comics. It has now incarnated and had a resurrection as Liquid Comics. So if you have a time, go on the internet and get to Liquid Comics. It's run by my son. And they're doing a lot of that, and they're extending it, but now not in paper, but on the internet.
All right, very good. Let's go next to Michael in Tucson, Arizona. Go ahead, Michael. Thank you.
Yes, this question is for Leonard.
All right.
Being that physics is impossible without arbitrary laws, and that we're supposedly evolving somewhere to a greater species or to something better or progress or going somewhere. Does that already have to exist? And on top of that, if the universe is moving somewhere unseen, is it blind?
And where's it?
Well, you know, I don't know if the universe follows arbitrary laws or I'm not sure. You know, we observe that the universe follows certain laws, and where they come from, physics can't really say, because physics, by definition, is the result of laws. We observe the laws, and then we calculate the results of the laws. So where the laws come from, we don't really say. But the... as the universe evolves, as you say, it's not evolution in the biological sense. It's just as the universe develops, you know, it develops according to those laws, and you know, we don't seem to see any particular. We don't see any need to have any intelligence behind that. It just follows the laws.
We have Barbara in Youngstown, Ohio. Let's see if we can squeeze you in real fast. Go ahead, Barbara.
Hi. Good morning. I had three amazing miracles, all documented in my life, and I was wondering if the gentleman had ever observed a miracle. These miracles were amazing, and I have medical records and everything. The one miracle was The first one was my husband had a vasectomy before we were married, and I had two diseased ovaries. We have four sons.
Wow.
The second one was my husband had a brain tumor that dissolved in front of the brain surgeon. And the last one was my five-year-old son was hit by a hit-and-run driver at 55 miles an hour. He was life-flighted to Cleveland Hospital, and when I got there, he was comatose, and we had him home and healed and without a trace of injury in 72 hours.
Well, I got to tell you, Barbara, you are living a chosen life here. I think every day life is a miracle. Deepak, would you agree?
Yes, I think that we exist is a perpetual surprise, and that's a miracle.
And Leonard?
I agree with that, too.
All right, you two. Good luck on War of the Worldviews. When did it come out? Did it just come out?
Just a week ago.
It came out October 4th.
Thanks for having us, and we hope that everybody will actually read these two perspectives in War of the Worldviews, the scientific and the spiritual, because that's the whole idea here, to further the conversation.
Absolutely. It's a great book, a great read by Deepak Chopra and Leonard Mlodinow. War of the Worldviews. For Dan Galanti, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasseur, Stephanie Smith, Ross Mitchell, George Knapp, Ian Punnett, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everybody.